Case Study 1. Multiple failures in care result in neurologically impaired infant. Robert Tierney, Assistant Vice President, claims. Milmick Insurance Company. The delivery. A 30-year-old female, Gravita 4, Para 3, was admitted for induction of labor at 42 weeks of gestation. The pregnancy was essentially unremarkable. Following the artificial rupture of membranes at 7:30 a.m., a Pitocin drip was started, and the dosage was gradually increased by protocol. At 12:05 p.m., a nurse first noted bleeding. At 12:10 p.m., the obstetrician placed an internal lead after performing a vaginal examination. An episode of bradycardia lasting 11 minutes was noted before recovery to baseline. During that time, the fetal heart rate fell below 100 beats per minute. At 12:30 p.m., the obstetrician ordered an epidural anesthesia and left the unit. As the anesthesiologist attempted to place the epidural catheter, the patient developed a leg cramp. Therefore, the epidural needle was removed. Placement was finally achieved at approximately 12:55 p.m., at which time the anesthesiologist also left the unit. The length of time that it took to place the epidural catheter was felt in no way to contribute to the fetal difficulties that subsequently ensued. Decelerations were noted during the 25 minutes that it took to complete the placement of the epidural catheter. This was followed by a prolonged deceleration with a decrease in beat-to-beat variability and a slow return to baseline. At 1:05 p.m., maternal blood pressures decreased to 81 over 50 following the epidural. The nurse's note reflects that the obstetrician was called and advised of those changes. At 1:10 p.m., the maternal blood pressure was 88 over 49 and the fetal heart rate was 150 to 160. At 1:15 p.m., the maternal blood pressure was 99 over 52, but the fetal heart rate was now below 90 beats per minute. Late decelerations were noted and the obstetrician was again notified. The obstetrician arrived at 1:23 p.m. At that time, the maternal blood pressure was 103 over 63 and the fetal heart rate was below 80 beats per minute. There were late decelerations with slow recovery and decreased variability on the EFM strips. A vaginal examination revealed the cervix to be 3 to 4 centimeters dilated, with bleeding again present. At 1:30 p.m., the fetal monitor showed minimal variability. At 1:35 p.m., the maternal blood pressure was 85 over 50, and the fetal heart rate was between 70 and 110 beats per minute. At this time, the nurses noted bright red bleeding. At 1:38 p.m., the obstetrician called for a cesarean section. The anesthesiologist responded and topped off the epidural at 1:52 p.m. The patient arrived in the operating room at 1:59 p.m. The fetal heart rate was now below 60 beats per minute. The first incision was made at approximately 2:12 p.m., and the infant was delivered at 2:15 p.m. Post-delivery observations. The baby boy weighed 8 pounds 9 ounces. He was extremely floppy at birth, with apgars of 1, 4, and 7 at 10 minutes. Free blood and clots were seen in the uterus at the time of the delivery, which strongly suggested a placental abruption. At 2 to 3 minutes of life, the baby was intubated by the anesthesiologist. The pediatrician arrived at 2:24 p.m. He documented chest compressions with a heart rate of 60. He also documented that the baby was still limp and blue and had a poor response to the resuscitative efforts. He suggested that the tube was misplaced, so the anesthesiologist re-intubated the baby. The baby's heart rate and color then improved. The anesthesiologist went back to care for the mother until 3 p.m. At 3:10 p.m., a chest X-ray of the infant revealed that the tip of the tube was directed toward the right mainstem bronchus. The radiologist's impression was that the tube was malpositioned. There is nothing documented in the medical record that reflects that the tube was subsequently raised. However, a second chest X-ray taken later showed that the tip of the tube was now above the carina. The child was maintained on mechanical ventilation, suffered seizures, and was transferred to a tertiary medical center. An MRI there showed encephalomelastic changes representing hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. The child suffered from cerebral palsy with spastic quadriparesis and profound cognitive and communication impairment. He required 24-hour home or institutional care. The baby had no genetic defects upon testing. Lawsuit and expert reviews. The plaintiff's parents commenced a lawsuit on the child's behalf against the hospital. They sued the pediatrician, a non-Milmic insured, the obstetrician and his partner, both Milmic insureds, their professional corporation, and the anesthesiologist, who was also a Milmic insured. The complaint alleged mismanagement of the plaintiff's labor and delivery. Medical experts in the fields of obstetrics, anesthesiology, and pediatrics reviewed this case. The obstetrical reviewer expressed concerns that at approximately 12:05 p.m., the electronic fetal monitoring tracing and the nurse's notes reflected maternal bleeding. The fetal monitor strips showed prolonged deep variable decelerations and a reduction in bead-to-bead variability. After the epidural was completed at 12:55 p.m., the strips demonstrated a bizarre pattern with almost complete loss of variability associated with a baseline of approximately 100 beats per minute with multiple short accelerations to 130 beats per minute. The electronic fetal monitoring strips continued to show ominous signs until approximately 1:40 p.m. when the emergency cesarean section was called. The obstetrical expert opined that the cesarean section should have been called for at around 12:30 p.m., which would have resulted in delivery of the fetus approximately 1 hour and 15 minutes sooner. The obstetrical reviewers recommended prompt settlement of the lawsuit. The anesthesiology reviewers opined that the insured anesthesiologist should have questioned the appropriateness of placing an epidural in a patient with bleeding and a fetus in distress. They also advised that he should have stayed with the mother to observe the effects of the epidural, which caused a decrease in blood pressure. They also were extremely critical of the lack of documentation by both the obstetrician and the anesthesiologist. The anesthesia record indicated that the epidural placement at 12:30 p.m. was essentially unremarkable. However, the nurse's notes reflect that the catheter was initially removed due to a possible injury to the patient. Further, the anesthesiologist entered no notes in the record regarding topping off the epidural at 1:52 p.m. The most damaging part of the anesthesia record were the vital signs of the mother taken between 12:30 p.m. and 2 p.m. The record showed repeated blood pressure entries of 115 over 55. However, the nurses had recorded blood pressures of 80 to 90 systolic. It was not clear whether the anesthesiologist was in attendance with the mother from 12:30 p.m. onward, as the cesarean section was called at 1:38 p.m., and the nurses' notes indicate that the anesthesiologist responded at 1:50 p.m. The anesthesia record also failed to reflect the time of the incision. Additionally, the anesthesiology record was extremely brief regarding the intubation of the infant. However, the nurse's notes indicate that the initial intubation by the anesthesiologist failed and that the infant was not successfully intubated until 9 minutes after delivery. This faulty record-keeping and poor documentation were very damaging to the credibility of the anesthesiologist. Because his credibility was completely compromised, his care could not be supported by an expert witness. Settlement. The plaintiff's initial demand to settle this matter was $11 million. Eventually, the case was settled for a total of $6.7 million. A total of $4.9 million was paid by Milmic. All of the policies of the obstetrician were used for the settlement. This included $1.3 million in primary coverage, $1 million in excess coverage through another carrier, and $1.3 million of the policy of his professional corporation. All of the anesthesiologist's policies were used as well. This included his primary policy of $1.3 million and the $1 million in coverage for his professional corporation. He did not have a policy of excess coverage. The non-Milmic insured pediatrician contributed $750,000 from his policy. The non-Melnick insured hospital paid $50,000 towards the settlement. Interestingly, this settlement occurred prior to the inception of the New York State Medical Indemnity Fund, to which these parents would have been directed to seek money for future medical expenses and devices. Case Study 1. A Legal and Risk Management Analysis. Donalene Richman, Esquire. Fager, Amsler, Keller & Schopman, LLP. Counsel to Melnick Insurance Company. Cases that involve brain-damaged infants are extremely expensive to resolve. This case revealed multiple legal concerns resulting from the care of both the anesthesiologist and obstetrician that made it very high risk to defend and made settlement imperative for both physicians. The main allegation against the obstetrician was a failure to recognize an abruption of the placenta in a timely manner. He then failed to order an emergency cesarean section, despite seeing and also being notified of bleeding during the patient's labor. His failure to act in a timely manner, in addition to the lawsuit, could also have subjected him to charges of professional misconduct if this case was reported by the plaintiff to the New York Department of Health Office of Professional Medical Conduct, OPMC. The obstetrician could also have been charged with patient abandonment. The patient's blood pressure and the fetal heart rates were seriously depressed, yet the obstetrician left the patient. He failed to return to see her for over an hour, despite being called by nurses several times. When he finally appeared, the fetus had already been severely compromised. Therefore, the appearance of a lack of concern for both the patient and fetus, without being able to articulate a rationale for doing so, seriously undermined any possible defense. The obstetrician then had no choice but to settle this case for not only his policy limits and excess insurance coverage, but also for his professional corporation's coverage. As required by law, this settlement was then reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank by Melnick Insurance Company. Further, the obstetrician was also obligated to update his New York State physician profile as a condition of registration renewal under Article 131 of the New York State Education Law. This must be done by all physicians in New York State within 6 months prior to the expiration date of the physician's registration period. The anesthesiologist had even more serious deficits in his care. He failed to have and document an informed consent discussion with this patient regarding the epidural anesthesia she was to undergo. He was obligated by law to discuss the risks, benefits, and alternatives to an epidural, including not having an epidural, and the risks of the alternatives. However, he failed to both have such a conversation and document the procedure itself, nor did he document the problems he had starting the epidural. However, because the nurses did document these difficulties, his version of these events that he gave to his counsel directly conflicted with the nurse's notes. It was suspected that the anesthesiologist inaccurately reflected his treatment on multiple occasions. There were two conflicting anesthesia records, and he failed to document the two attempts to start the epidural. These inaccuracies and the prior conflicts with the nurse's notes created suspicion that other aspects of the anesthesia records, such as the blood pressures entered during the emergency surgery, were also not accurate and/or poorly documented. These inaccuracies could be deemed to violate New York State Education Law 6530-32. This statutory provision requires that a physician maintain a record which accurately reflects the evaluation and treatment of the patient. Additionally, if the physician had in fact altered his records, that may be deemed a potential violation of altering a business record. Although the anesthesiologist was aware that the patient was bleeding and the fetus was showing significant signs of distress after he started the epidural anesthesia, he too left the patient and also failed to contact the obstetrician. This could be construed as patient abandonment if the plaintiff's counsel had reported him to OPMC. And while he claimed that he was never notified of continuing problems by the nursing staff until the cesarean section was called, the nurse's notes clearly contradicted his claims. Because of all of these deficits in his care, and especially the many alterations in his anesthesia record, it would have been impossible to permit this physician to testify under oath to a jury. When the anesthesiologist's care was reviewed by experts, they criticized his decision to top off the epidural rather than inducing rapid sequence general anesthesia. This action caused further delay in starting the cesarean section. The New York State Health Code at 10 NYCRR, paragraph 405.19, provides that an incision for an emergency cesarean should be made within 30 minutes from the decision to perform the surgery. This standard was not met. Of note, this physician also failed to document the actual time of the incision in his anesthesia record. His documentation regarding the baby's condition at birth and intubation status was also falsified. The nursing documentation showed his difficulty in starting the epidural anesthesia and is incorrectly intubating the baby. If he had testified and made the comments he did to his attorney about his excellent skills in intubation and providing epidural anesthesia, the jury might well have punished him for those remarks by rendering a very large verdict against him. In summary, despite the plaintiff's substantial monetary demands for the care of a severely compromised newborn, settlement of this case by both the obstetrician and the anesthesiologist was necessary to protect them from a judgment which exceeded the limits of all of their policies.